Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The typical medication for a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, is a pill. The Food and Drug Administration this month approved a very different strategy, a video game. After 7 years of clinical trials, the game earned approval for a new category that includes devices. When the game is launched, it will require a prescription from a physician, and there's already a wait list of children to try it. Neurologist Dr. Adam Guzzoli invented Endeavor RX. He is co-founder and chief science advisor of Achille Interactive. That's the company that makes the game. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me here.
You know, most parents think their kids play too many video games already. Is this a video game the likes of which we're familiar, or is it somehow different?
It's a great question. It's sort of like a little twist of the story that something that attention deficits often blamed on is now being formulated and validated as a treatment. It is a video game in many of the same ways that people are familiar with. It's fun, it's engaging, lots of rewards. But with this particular game, which I've been working on for the last 12 years, we designed the challenges and the rewards in the game in such a way to put challenges on the attention system such that after someone finishes playing the game for a month, which is how we prescribe it in our research studies, we find that their attention is improved afterwards in other tasks that they engage in. So for a child playing it, yeah, it's going to feel like a video game. But our research suggests that it has real meaningful benefits.
When you talk about the challenges in the attention, can you describe what you mean by that?
Sure. So many of us, whether or not you have a diagnosis of ADHD, often are challenged in our ability to focus. And not that it's probably even getting harder right now as the world gets more and more complicated.
Yeah.
But attention is a complicated phenomena, although it seems obvious what it is, but it has many different subtleties. So attention could be avoiding distraction. Attention could be your ability to shift your focus where you want it. Attention could be sustaining your attention and your focus on something that's really boring, even though you have to. So, for example, a child trying to focus in class when they're not motivated to, that ability to hold your focus, which is limited, our resources to direct our focus are not infinite. We can't focus on everything at the same time, so we have to make choices. We have to be selective about it. And many people have challenges with that ability, and then it goes on and impacts many other activities in their lives that demand focus.
Because it's doing something with the brain, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's how. So there's really two types of attention. One is where the world imposes itself upon what you pay attention to. So if there's like a crash, a flash of light, a loud noise, your attention goes there.
Mm-hmm.
The other is internal in your brain. It's based on your goals. You're choosing, your listeners now are choosing to direct what they're hearing to our conversation. And so, yes, that is a brain-directed process by which we focus on the world based upon our goals and our decisions.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And, yes, you are listening to Tech Tuesday, not Wellness Wednesday. We're talking about the use of a video game to treat ADHD. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us about the clinical trials that were done to earn that FDA approval. How did you test this? How was it tested?
Yeah, so we started doing studies with this video game a decade ago in different populations. Older adults was one of the first big studies we had in the journal Nature, showing that we can improve attention in healthy older adults. The company Achille, which licensed the technology behind this game, really focused their sights on children with ADHD because there's still so much unmet need in that population. And so there have been four clinical trials with children that have that diagnosis. And the big one, what we call a pivotal trial, was a multi-site trial, so many different sites, double-blinded, randomized using a placebo game, so a game that we didn't think would have any benefit, and then compared against it. And so really just it was run exactly like a drug trial is run. We treated this in every way as if it was a pill or a drug, even though it's a video game.
And what were you what decided that it was working? What were the factors that you were looking at, and what were you measuring?
Yeah, so our primary, so when you run a study like this, you declare beforehand what your primary outcome is. What is the main thing that you think you can affect differently than another treatment, usually like a placebo, in our case, this placebo game.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we were looking at was a test of sustained attention. That means the ability of the children in this study to hold their attention in this really, really boring test that was designed to be boring, and that children, especially those with ADHD, really suffer on. And that's what we showed improved in many children, returning them to normal levels after 1 month of video game play. And the reason we thought that was such an important outcome measure because it mimics the challenges that these children face in the real world, where they're holding their attention in activities that are just not exciting to them.
The neuropsychological assessment, it's called TOVA. It measures a person's attention while screening for ADHD. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, the test of variable attention. It's a laboratory test that also can be part of the diagnosis of ADHD as well. Correct.
And could it be that the kids are just playing it, are just getting better with practice, not that their ADD symptoms are getting better? How do you account for that?
Well, they're not practicing the TOVA, right? So they play we test the TOVA.
Uh-huh.
They engage in this game treatment, Endeavor RX, and then a month later, they're tested again. Now, remember, there's another group of children with ADHD that played a different video game that did the same thing, and their TOVA didn't change at all.
Okay.
But these children show this really remarkable improvement in their ability to hold their attention consistently over the course of this boring test.
And so as far as you know, the only thing that changed was that they were using the game treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Other than that, the groups were exactly the same.
Right. And what do you mean by game treatment? I mean, what does a prescription look like for something like this?
Yeah, we're really in new territory. It seems like science fiction that we're now talking about a video game as medicine. But that was really our intentions and my dream all along, that we wouldn't just think about a pill as medicine. We need to open our minds and be broader in what we think can help people. So in this case, we're looking at a prescription that's based upon the same protocol we used in these studies. And what that is that a child would play the game for 30 minutes a day. So no more. The game won't allow you to play more for 5 days a week for 1 month. So that's effectively a dose of this medicine. And then we will observe the effects and we could redose. And that's where we're going with our research to understand exactly how much of this treatment is appropriate for each child.
And this is the stuff that was tested, the 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 1 month.
Correct.
How do you... if it's working, why not do it for another month? Why the 1 month?
Well,
couldn't you just keep doing it? Yeah.
Sure. So when you do a study, you pick a dosage of anything, even whether it's a pill or a treatment like this, that you believe will have an effect because that's what you need to show in the study to see if it works or not.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly don't want to just go beyond and beyond because eventually people will start dropping out and maybe not being as compliant. So in our previous work, we found that amount, that dosage, that amount of time of engagement with the game, because you have to remember, although it's a game, it's really challenging. It's meant to really push on these abilities, and it could be frustrating. And so a month felt like a reasonable amount of time. And now we've shown in a new study that the benefits last a month without playing the game. And then you could get more benefits from playing the game another month. So that's the stage that we're at now, and this is pretty typical with any treatment, is that first you show it works in some dosage that was picked based upon, you know, previous experience that would show an effect. Now you start figuring out all the details, exactly how much is beneficial. We certainly don't want a child to play this for longer than they need to get the benefit.
This is for pediatric ADHD. What age groups are you talking about with this?
So the age group that was in the study, and that is part of our indication, are children from 8 to 12 years old. But we are now expanding the age group, including adult ADHD and seniors with attention challenges, to see if it has benefits outside of that age group. But that was the age group that was studied in those clinical trials.
And this is a new regulatory category. Did they have to establish the category for you?
Yes. So that was another challenge. This has been all sorts of challenges over the last decade in trying to turn a video game into medicine. Essentially, there is no previously existing what's called a predicate in the field that we rely on.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes through a pathway in the FDA that they call a de novo pathway, basically a new pathway. And once something gets approved, like we were just approved for this particular game, then it establishes a new category, which allows future video game treatments, even for other conditions, to be more facilitated in the process.
Are you working on other games to treat this or anything else?
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot going on and has been going on. This is the first that just sort of made the news in this way because it passed this milestone with the FDA. But this particular game has been studied in multiple other clinical conditions and shows benefit. For example, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, multiple sclerosis, looking at it in aging and the early phases of dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my laboratory, a research center that I run at my university, at University of California, San Francisco, we have a half a dozen other games that we've built over the last year. Some of them are rhythm and dance. Others are meditation-based. And some use tablets and phones like this game, and others use things like virtual reality. So we think that there's an entire new, essentially a new industry. Like we have the pharmaceutical industry for pills. This is a whole new class of medicine that could have benefits across many, many different conditions where people are suffering.
One of the things about drugs is they have side effects. And that's part of what the trials are looking for. What are the side effects and the cost benefit analysis, to humans?
Yep.
What about side effects from games? I mean, is it as rigorous at looking for side effects in games the regulators, as they are looking for side effects from drugs?
Oh, yeah. It's exactly the same.
And so I guess bad side effects is what we mean.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why we went through this route of an FDA approval as a medical device and these giant trials, because I believe that anything that can do good can do bad, right? You have to always look at both sides. And so we rigorously test for side effects. Fortunately, in our trials, this is one of the advantages that we have, is that the side effects are much lower than they are for pharmaceuticals in our experience. So we do see some minor side effects. For example, the game is challenging, and for some children, they'll report frustration as a side effect. There's a small percentage of children that might have a headache after playing because they're exerting themselves so intensely.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, we had no serious side effects, which really differentiates it from a lot of other treatments.
And when you talk about, adapting the game to older kids, adults, older people, maybe, how do you tweak it? I mean, is each iteration going to have to go through the same rigorous trial process?
Yeah, so it's a really, really good question. Obviously, that is our future, so it's still unmarked territory. But what we believe, and at least in our discussions, what we're finding is that the game, sort of like if you imagine a pill, has what we call an active ingredient. There might be other elements in there, but then there's one that really leads to the effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have in our game an active ingredient. It's part of a patent. It's a method of delivering challenges and rewards that's very specific for this game that we see across all of our studies. So we could preserve that and then change other elements of the game, like the story and maybe some aspects of art and the characters that you're engaging with, that would make it more appealing to different populations, but wouldn't change the underlying ingredient that causes the benefit and therefore doesn't need constant reapproval to make it more appropriate for different populations.
And when is this going to be available? I know that people are kind of queuing up for it, but when's it going to be available for prescription?
soon. So we've been in this process for a long time, and a lot of the time over the last couple of years was just working with the FDA and making the case that this is appropriate as a medical treatment. And now that we've passed that hurdle, we certainly have work to do to distribute this. As we talked earlier, it doesn't really have a pathway, of what it's like to write a prescription. And obviously, we're seeking things like insurance reimbursement. And so we have a lot to do.
Okay.
But we do want to get this out soon because we have seen its benefit and it's timely. The crisis that we're in, that's impossible to ignore right now.
The pandemic, right.
Coronavirus. Mm-hmm. The pandemic is proving, probably unsurprising to people, to aggravate things like distractibility and its consequences like anxiety and stress and sleep problems. So we see a very we're very motivated to get this out very soon. So it will be available soon. Right now there's a wait list, so we know who the people are that are really interested in it. So when we're ready to distribute it, we could get it to them as rapidly as possible.
And what about the price point on this? I'm talking about insurance approval, which is a whole nother process, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another process.
Yeah, but how do you price something like this?
Yeah, so that is one of the main things that we're working on over this month, to do it in a way that's appropriate for the resources that went into its development, but also makes it accessible to people. And so, we have other markers in the industry of what's currently used for drugs and pills, whether they be on label or generics.
Uh-huh.
And so we're using those markers and trying to come in at, a really favorable price point for people. That's our goal here.
And you patent it, and they patent drugs, but eventually they go generic, right? Do you envision this going generic someday?
Yeah, sure. This is sort of the fun and challenging part, is that we're on new territory here. And we see this game as having benefits in many different populations than maybe an over-the-counter version that's more accessible to people without a diagnosis, but also who have attention challenges, which there are many of. That's certainly something that we're exploring.
And in your research, I know I'm holding you over a little bit, but we have an email from Jennifer. She asks a really good question about why her son with ADHD can focus on video games but not schoolwork. What's the difference there? I mean, to me, it's because they're more fun.
You're right. That's what the data would suggest. We're actually doing research on that right now. There's not a ton of research on it, but what it seems, and my hypothesis is, based upon my study of attention and based upon some research, is that your ability to deploy your attention is what I would call context dependent. And so there is some context that's more fun and engaging and rewarding, and children are able to focus, and then others where they're not being rewarded appropriately,
okay.
They're not motivated. But then there are some children that just seemingly can't do it under any conditions, and we're trying to understand that better. What makes this game so our results so impressive is that, yes, they get better at the game, but they also get better at deploying their attention under really boring setting. That's why we've been able to
gotcha.
Make it this far.
Well, Dr. Anam Guzzali, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Anam Guzzali is a neurologist and inventor of Endeavor RX. It's a video game to treat pediatric ADHD. It is not yet on the market, but it will be soon. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. A new study by a national nonprofit group and Google shows that a majority of small businesses have managed to hang on during the pandemic shutdown thanks to digital tools and services. The Connected Commerce Council is a national nonprofit that works to promote access to essential digital technologies and tools on behalf of its 4,000 small business members. Jake Ward is president of the Connected Commerce Council. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you have to create a whole separate council? Why not just go through the, you know, National Federation of Independent Businesses or their small, you know, Small Business Administration or something like that?
As you know, there are a number of organizations, nonprofits, trade associations that represent the interests of small businesses. We wanted to be pretty specific about what it is that we were trying to deliver to those businesses, which was better access to the tools and services and online platforms that were powering the next generation of growth. What we found is that whether it's the Chamber of Commerce or NFIB or franchises, all of which are great organizations doing great work, we wanted to be less of an advocacy organization and more of a resource for businesses.
So the study showed that one-third of businesses surveyed would have closed all or parts of their operations without digital tools. What types of technology was particularly helpful, did you find?
I think that the move to online sales, e-commerce platforms for a lot of brick-and-mortar stores was a remarkable lifeline. Much of the research demonstrated what we call the digital safety net, which is the idea that the more incorporated and more fundamental online tools and services were for a small business, the more easily they adjusted. They were agile and able to expand their marketing and reach a larger audience through online sales. They were able to integrate e-commerce or rely more on e-commerce than previously. They were driven by data from analytics rather than the sort of paralysis that can come from uncertainty and instability.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Jack Ward, president of the Connected Commerce Council. It's a national nonprofit promoting digital tech and tools for small businesses. And the shutdown caused by the pandemic has certainly put that to the test. That's what we're talking about right now. Did big tech donated time and resources to this endeavor, right?
Absolutely. Big tech, you know, larger tech, the larger platforms generally are investing billions of dollars into small business tools and resources, as well as programs like 3C research that targets the fundamentals of our changing economy to better understand what products these small businesses need and what we can all do to support them as they drive us out of this crisis.
And how important is it to keep those tools low cost or free going forward?
How high can you count?
Yeah.
The access to these tools and services in the digital age is the difference between an idea and execution, or the difference between failure and success. To start a small business now has never been easier than before. You can, for a very low price, create a website, build enterprise quality suites of tools like email and analytics. You can use online advertising through Instagram, Facebook, Google, myriad of other choices. You can sell goods and services through eBay or Etsy or Amazon or Shopify and compete with companies much larger, much older, who have had a foothold in that space for decades. And the real winner of that competition is the user, is the consumer, is all of us.
So how do you keep those tools free or low cost going forward? Someone's got to pay the piper, right?
Well, as long as the model is maintained where a Google invests in the development of the G Suite to support small businesses and the quantity of small businesses utilizing those tools makes it worthwhile, you're going to continue to see low cost, accessible, affordable, secured, and scalable tools made available for small business. One of the remarkable things that's happened in the last 10 to 15 years is that big business has found that there is profit to be made, there is gains to be made in the market selling to this emerging small business class, which is where you get Salesforce and Constant Contact and Intuit and dozens more businesses creating specific software tools for small business use. The only impediment to access for small businesses utilizing those tools and expanding their markets or their business models is potential government intervention. Hmm. The threat of disruption or instability to access to those tools, frankly, is the second largest risk facing small businesses right now beyond the COVID crisis.
I know there are small business owners out there listening right now. If you're have a small business and you used digital tools to survive, such as it is nowadays during the pandemic shutdown, give us a call and tell us how it helped. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Otherwise, we're going to talk about an oyster farmer in New York who had a surplus of perishable goods after restaurants closed. They got a crash course in how to do business differently. What did they do, Jack Ward?
Well, Pete Stein is an entrepreneur, is an oyster farmer. He serves many restaurants in New York over the past several years. But with the widespread closure of those restaurants in New York City, business was rocky, to say the least. Pete partnered with a number of other small businesses, including an Illinois-based culinary service called Spice House that I encourage everybody to check out. Their stuff is incredible. And figured out a way to package and ship oysters direct to consumer. Having purchased the Pico oysters myself and had them delivered to my house in South Carolina.
Are they really good?
I can assure you. Yeah, I did. they travel well and they are delicious. But what he largely did was expand his geographic range, right? If you're an oyster farmer, you don't traditionally think about serving a regional area beyond 100 to 300 miles. But Pete was able to expand that with YouTube videos, Instagram advertising, and shipping support from FedEx and UPS that was able to get his product where it needed to be in a time where it was still viable.
Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What did you do?
We have a gluten-free bakery and coffee shop on the south side of Columbus. In a weekend, we literally utilizing Square Store, put all of our inventory into the system. And, you know, by that Tuesday when we reopened, we had a completely pre-order system, completely contactless, and we literally would not have been able to survive that type of switch over without technology.
You know, interestingly, that study that we're talking about, Lisa, found that women are more likely than men to adapt to these digital tools. And I'm wondering, Jack Ward, why, you know, what we know about why that is.
I'm not sure that we can assign any particular motivation behind
it. It's not
it.
A superiority thing or anything like
well,
that.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think the willingness to be flexible, the less stubborn and significantly smarter certainly helps. That's wonderful news about the incorporation of the Square Store into your bakery. Congratulations on making that shift. I hope that you're able to. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Lisa, still on the line?
Yeah.
I'm curious, is it your intention sort of post-COVID when social distancing and quarantine restrictions are lifted, are you going to keep and maintain that online store so that you're able to move orders and sort of diversify that distribution?
We actually decided to not reopen our feeding area. We are going to stay with the pre-order system.
Wow.
You know, I think we realized that from a square footage perspective, how could we bring in additional revenue using that space? And so we're kind of going to this curated bodega type.
Yeah.
Completely gluten-free concept. So no, we are staying with the pre-order system.
Huh.
That's great. Right. But what we're seeing a lot, Anne, actually, is that's what we refer to as forced digitization,
mm-hmm.
which is the idea that for a long time, we've known that these tools, whether you're a big business or a little business, were part of just sort of the infrastructure. And the more you integrated them, the more you would rely on them.
Mm-hmm.
This crisis has forced us all to consider our geographic range, our physical footprint, the cost we are placing on square footage and ways to diversify our businesses.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Good luck with all of that. And Mary in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Ann. I have a small yoga studio up here in Delaware County. And when we were had to close down, I went to all live classes over Zoom. And most of my students stayed with me. And even though I've just reopened, most of my students are still continuing to do Zoom classes rather than coming to the studio.
Have you thought about what we just talked about with Lisa, like eliminating the studio going forward, saving the money on that square footage and just going with digital?
I have, because rent's not cheap, obviously.
Yeah.
And I'm small to start with. And with the restrictions of the distancing, I can only put three or four people in the room. And it just, you know, financially, that's not going to hold up. So, yeah, I have definitely considered. And most of my students have said they either like the fact that they don't have to drive to and from the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are staying away because of the concern about the spread of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them are just finding they like live classes versus a recorded class in their homes.
Yeah. A very different kind of business, Jake Ward, right? But same kind of what you were just talking about.
You know, we've seen more and more of that. Zoom has become a verb, right? It's become a thing that we use to connect through space that has just been remarkable. I think that indicators were there in terms of programs like Peloton that exercise particularly was going to be something we were more comfortable doing in our own homes over video with a little bit of pressure on that marketplace. But that's wonderful that you've been able to weather this storm and that your customers stayed loyal. Though I'm not surprised. Yoga is one of those things that feels more like family than a business.
Yeah. Mary, thanks for that call. What has been the biggest obstacle to embracing digital tools for small businesses? Is it a geographic thing? We certainly have talked about that a lot because of the digital divide in this country. Jack Ward, what do you know about that?
It'll surprise you, Ann, but the biggest barrier to entry for digital tools is success. That small businesses that are able to sustain and have sustained for multiple years with the model that they have, see no reason to change. And that success creates an apathy, whereas a small business that has been launched in the last 5 years, for example, is much more likely to have immediately embraced digital tools, online marketing, e-commerce, because it's just it's part and parcel of the infrastructure of a modern small business. And those businesses we found were more resilient, were more agile in the face of the COVID crisis. But the barrier to entry is not, as we might have assumed, sort of technical savvy. The truth is many of these tools are intuitive, easy to incorporate, and the support mechanisms, whether it be organizations like mine or the companies and providers themselves, are there and available. The number one barrier to entry is long-term success that made it not seem necessary.
Interesting. Well, Jack Ward, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jack Ward is president of the Connected Commerce Council. That's a national nonprofit promoting digital tech and tools for small businesses. And thanks to the two callers. Those are great examples. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The pandemic has forced the annual Apple Worldwide Developers Conference online for the first time, which is kind of ironic. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is there virtually. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what's the big news?
Yeah, so Apple takes, you know, the first day of their developer conference every year to take a look at what's coming next for all of their operating systems. This is an attempt to get developers to prepare their apps so that when the next iPhone and iPad and Apple Watch come out in the fall, These apps are already, you know, ready to go, and everything looks nice and works well when that big software update comes out to your existing iPhone or when you pick up a new iPhone. So what we saw at the conference yesterday during their big keynote is a bunch of new stuff coming to the iPhone operating system. There's going to be a lot of new things done with folders. You know, instead of making it so that you have to swipe through a whole bunch of different pages of icons like you do on the iPhone right now, it's going to be a lot easier to, you know, kind of search for things that you're looking for or have apps kind of bundled in different groups to make it easier to find things that you're looking for. If you have apps that you use every day, for example, I, you know, the first thing I do when I pick up the phone every day is check the weather to see what it's going to be like that day. You know, they're actually going to have the weather app, you know, just kind of constantly pinned to your home screen through what they're calling widgets. Which is a thing if you use an Android phone before you're familiar with the general format there. But they're doing a really clever thing with widgets in that that face will actually change throughout the day based on the apps that you use a whole lot. So I use the weather app in the morning, but I ended up using my calendar app kind of midday. So the idea is that face on your phone would show the weather in the morning, but then when you get to like noon, it would just change over to your calendar automatically. Which is kind of a cool way of doing it.
So that was one of eight features that Apple took from Android, right? And I do miss that about my Android phone, by the way. It's interesting that they picked up on that. It's sort of something I've kind of, you know, mourned, but, you know, there's other things to enjoy about it, too. What else did they take from Android?
So there's just a ton going on here. The other, you know, big thing that you're gonna see from if you've used an Android phone before and you're coming over to the iPhone is just the way that you're going to be able to kind of navigate the operating system. So the widgets thing are a big thing, but also having your apps in a way that just isn't in that paged format is gonna make a big deal. You know, a lot of Android users are used to that app drawer, you know, where you can kind of swipe up and see everything either in an alphabetical list or in a list of things that you use more often. Mm-hmm. And this is gonna have much more of that feel. When you want to go through those pages, you're also going to be able to kind of, you know, take a look at each one of those windows, you know, the different pages that have the apps. You're going to be able to look at them all at once when you kind of do that swipe up thing on your phone, unless you're using a phone that has the home screen button still.
I thought that the iPhone already did show apps at the bottom that you use the most.
So that it has that four or five icon bar at the bottom that you can kind of customize and set whatever you want.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of people have, you know, at this point, you know, up to 40 or 50 apps on their phone. And then you have crazy people like me that have closer to 200. So, you know, thumbing through all of those things, unless you use the apps every day is, you know, it's not always easy to find.
Right. The app clips, what's that? It speeds up tasks.
App clips, you know, this is another thing that kind of got borrowed from Android. Android calls this, they're called instant apps. But the app clips for iOS, you know, instead of downloading an entire application, because sometimes apps can be pretty big, the idea here is that when you're just using it for that one time, let's say you're at a parking meter, and the parking meter has an app so that you don't have to, you know, pull out coins from a coin box in your car. You can just kind of tap your phone and pay that way. This will load just the part of the app that allows you to complete that transaction instead of taking up space on your phone by installing the whole app. So this is, you'd be able to use this at, you know, your local pizza place, or, you know, if you are, you know, trying to use a parking pass, you know, application or something like that, you're only going to use once. That's the whole idea, is that instead of installing the whole app for something you're only going to use the one time, you can just kind of do this quick, you know, either hold your phone out to tap to this thing to kind of load the app, or have a QR code that you'd be able to scan with your camera and be able to just use that one section of the app that one time, and then it's not installed on your phone, but you still get to, you know, have the benefits of having that app on your phone.
You opined on Twitter, I think it was yesterday, that there was no big announcement about artificial intelligence.
It wasn't just that it was augmented reality, and it wasn't it wasn't that there wasn't any big announcement. It didn't get mentioned at all. Apple had a two-hour keynote where in the past, you know, augmented reality on your phone and on your tablet had been kind of big things. And we've known that Apple is planning to release a set of augmented reality glasses, maybe not this year, maybe next year. But this is something that Apple's clearly been working on behind the scenes with the people they've been hiring and the technology they've been securing patents for. But the augmented reality didn't get mentioned at all. In fact, no actual physical hardware got mentioned aside from a special new processor that Apple is working on for its laptops and its desktops, which is it's more in line with the kind of processors they're using for their phones. That's completely made by Apple instead of their previous partnerships with Intel.
So what does that say to you that it wasn't mentioned at all?
Well, there's two things. One, Apple is very, very good at the hands-on experience after events like this. And one of the things that Apple has always done very well when it comes to these press events is saying, hey, we've got this thing so that people watching a stream can go, wow, that's really cool. But then they take you to a separate room when you're there at the event to go and actually touch that thing and write those things up. So for Apple to not mention any hardware, I think that's just an effect of the environment that was here. You know, Apple couldn't physically take a group of journalists into another room and say, check this thing out for yourself. Don't just take our word for it. So they just didn't mention hardware at all. And I think, you know, the software that kind of goes behind that is an important thing. You know, unless Apple can say, you know, this is what we're working on, here's the software that powers it, it's not really all that helpful. So I think that was why it didn't get mentioned, but it's still, you know, augmented reality has been a big part of the phone experience for Apple for 2 years now. And it was interesting to see that kind of missing.
Well, do you think it's going to hurt them going forward if they can't adjust? Because I don't think these long, you know, these remote, you know, events are going away anytime soon.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think Apple, you know, Apple doing a hardware launch this year, which they're going to have to do in order to release a new iPhone and an Apple Watch, Apple's going to have a new strategy. They're not going to be able to lean on the things that they have done up until this point. And there's not been a lot of evidence that they're prepared for that yet. So it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, kind of where that goes, because they're not going to be able to gather people around an Apple store like they used to. You know, this event in particular, these keynotes, weren't just broadcast online. People used to, and I say used to like it was 10 years ago, people used to gather in large groups in front of the giant televisions in Apple stores to watch these keynotes and then be able to talk to Apple store employees to ask questions. And you just can't do that right now. You know, and it's unclear that that's going to be something you're going to be able to do in September when these phones would normally be announced and then released.
There is a watch operating system, 7. What's new about that? And then I'll tell you my sad story about my watch. Go on.
Oh, no. So there's a lot of the features coming to the watch are all about you know, this continued push into health and fitness that Apple has had, you know, so making it easier to automatically detect different kinds of workouts, including one that got that has been requested for a really long time, which is actually dance workouts. People who do dance studios and things like that, you know, you hadn't been able to really record that accurately so far.
Right.
And Apple has released a couple of different kinds of dance recording techniques in order to make that work. There's also going to be sleep tracking. So that you will be able to, you know, monitor how well you're sleeping and actually set specific alarms on your wrist to make it better for you to wake up. You know, so different kinds of wake up techniques so that you're not woken up kind of aggressively. And then kind of a personal favorite of mine is better tools for cyclists. So they're working with Apple Maps to help you plan routes in order to determine where the safest path would be, where the least amount of traffic is for people who are riding their bike, but also turn-by-turn directions for cycling and navigation on your wrist. So when you're supposed to be turning, you know, you wouldn't have to look down at a phone. The watch will kind of, you know, tap on you and let you know that it's time to turn.
Interesting. Also, a new hand-washing feature?
Yes, the new hand-washing feature is cute. So it's not clear how that's going to be turned on automatically. But the idea is it starts a counter on your watch that lets you know how long you're supposed to be washing your hands and making sure that it's being done for the appropriate length of time. And if you stop before the timer is over, it'll actually ping your wrist and say, hey, you're not quite done yet, to let you know. Unfortunately, it doesn't have a feature that will blare from your wrist like an alarm if you leave the bathroom without washing at all, which I think would probably be a better thing.
Be
to
a
let
shaming kind of a tool.
That's right. Yeah. I'm a big fan of watch shaming. That's cool. So what happened to your watch?
Oh, I can't. It just disconnected from my phone or whatever. It didn't, whatever you call that, unpaired. And I can't get it paired back up. And I went to the, you know, the geniuses. I couldn't even get into the store. They aren't allowing browsing. But I did talk to the guy out in the mall. He's like, do this, take it home. It should be a problem. Well, neither I nor my 24-year-old son could get it to pair. It just won't pair up. It's like it went away. And so I got to go back in there. It's really bumming
me out.
That's
such a bummer.
Yeah, it's total bummer. I mean, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to sleep with my watch on, though.
Well, not only would you, you know, not everyone is going to want to sleep with your watch on, but it raised a really interesting question. If you wear the watch all day long and you wear the watch all night long, when do you charge the watch?
Yeah, good point.
Because the Apple Watch still has to be charged once a day.
Right.
And the joke that I made yesterday was that you would just charge it, you know, when you were in the shower. But the Apple Watch takes an average of an hour and a half to charge, so that's a pretty long shower.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know. The iPad operating system 14. There is a handwriting feature that they claim is as easy as typing in notes. Really?
Yeah, so it's worth keeping in mind that Apple has been a pioneer in handwriting technology for a really long time, and it just kind of forgot that for a while because the Apple Newton computer, I guess, 23 years ago,
oh my gosh,
had handwriting technology built into it. So this is not actually a new thing for Apple to explore. But it's stopped doing handwriting recognition for a long time, and with competition from Microsoft and Google, Apple has kind of brought that back. You know, the Surface computers have been fantastic with handwriting recognition, and Google has started doing the same thing inside of their Chromebook. So this is kind of Apple catching up a little bit here. But yeah, the idea is that when you're in Notes, you'll be able to write with reasonable accuracy and have the handwriting recognition convert your handwriting to text. And given my handwriting, I'm really curious to test that because it's not great. But on top of that, it'll actually intelligently, you know, correct shapes and things as you go to draw them. So if you draw an octagon and the octagon is a little lopsided, Apple will actually go in and correct it if you tell it to and make it, you know, make it an accurate octagon.
I like the idea of that in the art section.
Yeah, I think that has the potential to be really interesting, but also. It has to be super accurate, you know. So I think when you think about autocorrect on your keyboard, the number of times that your autocorrect gets things wrong, if you can imagine how frustrating that would be in handwriting, because I promise you, Apple, I'm not saying ducking when I'm writing it down either. So hopefully that gets fixed.
And there's an upgrade to Scribble. What's Scribble? Do I have that?
No, Scribble is kind of the name of the underlying technology, and you can install Scribble right now if you want to, but this is a way of kind of taking the technology and integrating it deeper into the operating system. So the idea is that when you're writing messages to people, you'll have the option to use handwriting recognition to do so. And again, that's a really cool idea if it ends up being as accurate as they claim it is.
You wanted to talk about Stadia on-screen touch controls?
Yeah, this was kind of fascinating. So, you know, the concept behind Google Stadia was that you were going to be able to attach a controller to a phone or a tablet and be able to play big PC games.
Yeah.
And be able to play them anywhere. And so far it's been functional, but not particularly popular, especially compared to Xbox Game Pass. And Google has tried to make this a little more accessible to everyone by removing the need for a controller. So they're putting the controller button on your phone so that you can just have your phone and be able to play these games. And this is something that has been done across iPhone and Android and you know, even Windows Phone back when that was a thing for quite a while now. And it's just never been super successful because it's just not the same thing. Like being able to move your fingers across a joystick and press buttons, that's kind of a muscle memory thing that you build up when you play those kind of games.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that on a glass screen just doesn't feel the same. So it's cool that you can play these games anywhere, but when you think about kind of the really intense games that are offered, you know, not being able to see the whole screen because your thumbs are covering it can be kind of problematic.
And just the tactile part of it.
Right, it just doesn't feel quite the same. So it's a really great kind of accessibility thing that is available now. If you're a Google Stadia person, or if you wanted to try it now, it's something you can do. Just go to the Stadia website and you can try it from your phone. But it is definitely not the same thing as using an actual controller.
Well, we're out of time. You talk really fast, but we still didn't have time to get to everything, Russell Holley. Thanks for the effort.
Not a problem.
That's Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.